her own safety. Perhaps she was merely tired, but the Queen thought not. Grief sat on her plainly, like a raven perched on her shoulder. The girl was studying the Queen now, staring at each of her features in turn, as though trying to dissect her face and put it back together. "She recognizes me," the Queen thought for a fearful moment. But how could she? How could anyone? This wasn't the woman from the portrait. This girl was only 19 years old.
"How old are you really?" the girl asked abruptly, in Mort.
Good Mort hers, with only the barest hint of an accent. "Far older than you," the Queen replied steadily, pleased to hear that her voice betrayed none of the upheaval in her thoughts. "Old enough to know when I have won."
"You have won," the girl replied slowly, but her eyes continued to dart across the Queen's face as though seeking clues.
"Well?"
"I've seen you before," the girl mused.
"We all have visions."
"No," the girl replied. "I've seen you. But where?"
Something tightened in the Queen's chest. "Only 19, she reminded herself. "What can it possibly matter?"
"You want these."
The girl held the sapphires up on her palm. Even in the diffuse light that filtered through the fabric of the tent, the jewels sparkled, and the Queen thought she could see something far in their depths. But then the girl shook them, and whatever she believed she had seen was gone. "They are pretty jewels, certainly."
"They come with a price."
"Price?" The Queen laughed, although even she could hear the slight edge in her laughter. "You're in no position to bargain."
"Of course I am," the girl replied.
Her green gaze speared the Queen with bright intelligence. Sometimes one could look in the eyes and simply see it, in the focus of the pupil, the sharpness of the gaze. "You can kill me, Lady Crimson. You can invade my city and lay it waste. But neither of those things will get the sapphires from around my neck. I'm sure you know what happens if you try to take them by force." The Queen sat back, discomforted. The girl did have a bargaining chip, after all. And the Queen wondered who had talked. Thomas Raleigh? Thorn? "I can simply order some other poor soul to kill you and take them off," the Queen replied after a long moment. "What do I care?"
"And that will work, will it?" the girl asked. The arrogance in her voice staggered the Queen.
Most information concerning the Tyr sapphires was myth and legend. No one had tried to take them by force since the death of Jonathan Tyr. But the Dark Thing had said it could be done. And now the Queen had a truly terrible thought, one that hit her right in her solar plexus. What if the Dark Thing had lied to her so long ago? What if it had only needed her to procure the sapphires, do its dirty work, and take the punishment?
"Good," the girl nodded. "Think on these things. Because I tell you, anyone who tries to take them against my wishes will suffer agony.
And if your hand merely guides them, my vengeance will find you as well." "I have been cursed before. You don't frighten me." But the Queen was unsettled all the same. She had overcome the awful idea that the woman from the portrait had come to life before her. But still the girl's face mocked her, raising the ghost of the past. She could not be sure that the girl was bluffing. And the stakes, if she guessed wrong. "Those jewels have had no proper owner since William Tyr." "Wrong." The girl bared her teeth again, her eyes burning with a fierce emotion, something like jealousy.
"They're mine."
The Queen was appalled to find herself believing this nonsense. So little was known about the magic of jewels. Several special pieces had come out of the Cadarese mines over the years, but nothing with power even remotely comparable to that of the Tyr sapphires. The Queen had never heard of a jewel bonding with a specific owner. So far as she knew, possession was everything in this game.
But she also didn't think the girl was lying. Her gaze was too clear for that. And she didn't strike the Queen as much of a liar to begin with.
I don't know, the Queen admitted to herself, and that was the crux of the problem. Uncertainties abounded here. She wanted to ask the girl about the dark thing, try to glean some further information about her abilities. But she was afraid to raise either issue, afraid to give the girl any more leverage. She was no fool, this one. She had come with a plan.
I do know you.
The Queen looked up, found the girl's eyes bright with revelation.
In the portrait.
The girl tipped her head to one side, fixing the Queen with a critical stare.
The disfavored child. The bastard. She was you.
The Queen slapped the girl across the face, but she had only a moment to admire the welt she had made before she was seized as though with invisible hands and thrown across the room to land on the thick, sumptuous pallet she used as a bed. She had not been pushed so much as flung, and if she had landed with equal force against something of iron or steel, she would probably be dead. She sprang up, ready to fight. But the girl had remained at the table, motionless, the Queen's handprint ugly and stark on her cheek. I am in danger, the Queen realized suddenly. The thought was so novel that it took a moment to become frightening. Somehow the girl had reached right inside her, right through the defenses that the Queen kept around her person at all times.
How had she done that?
The Queen rallied herself. She should return to the table. But something had shifted now, and even with her defenses up, the Queen found that she did not want to cross the room.
You don't like being recognized, the girl mused. Was life with the beautiful Queen really so bad?
The Queen snarled, an animal sound that lashed through her teeth before she could hold it back. She had forgotten about the damned portrait. It must still be lying around the keep somewhere. Their last family moment before all hell had broken loose. But the Queen had shed that sad child as though she were emerging from a chrysalis. The girl should never have been able to connect the two. The Queen thought about calling for Ducat, but she couldn't seem to open her mouth.
I have poor vision, the girl remarked, but my jewels are useful. Sometimes I see. I simply see. Where other people might notice nothing.
She stood up from the table and approached the Queen slowly, her gaze appraising, and worse, pitying.
You're a Raleigh, aren't you?
A bastard Raleigh, unloved and unwanted, and always forgotten. The Queen felt her guts twist. I am not a Raleigh. I am the Queen of Mortmain. But the words sounded feeble, even to her own ears.
"Why do you hate us so much?" the girl asked. "What did they do to you?"
"Evie, come here. I need you."
The Queen shuddered. The woman's face, her mother's voice, one was bad, but both were too much to bear. She tried to gather herself, to find some of the control she'd had when the girl first entered the tent. But whatever she took hold of seemed to melt in her hands.
Evie!
More impatient now, her mother's voice, a bit of steel showing through. The Queen clapped her hands to her ears, but that did no good, for the girl was already inside her head. The Queen could feel her there, reading the Queen's memories as though they were a novel, running through them, flipping the pages, pausing on the worst moments. The Queen stumbled away, but the girl followed her across the tent, across her mind, leafing through the past and discarding it behind her. Elaine, her mother, the keep, the portrait, the dark thing. They were all there, called up suddenly as though they had been waiting all along.
I see, the girl murmured, her voice laced with sympathy. She traded you away.
They all did.
Queen Elaine got everything. The Queen shrieked, wrapping her arms around herself and clawing at her own skin.
Don't do that.
The girl pulled up the sleeve of her dress, and the Queen saw that her left arm was a mess of welts, some new, some healing. The sight was so shocking, so contrary to what the Queen thought she knew about the girl, that her hands dropped away from her own arms.
I do it too, you know, the girl continued, to control my anger.
But it does no good in the long run. I see that now. Dukat burst through the doorway of the tent, his sword drawn, but the girl whirled toward him, and suddenly Dukat was doubled over, choking, his hands clasped around his throat.
Don't interfere, Monsieur General. Stay over there, and I will allow you to breathe.
Dukat backed toward the far wall of the tent. The girl turned back to the Queen, her green eyes contemplative. The Queen's mind ached, a feeling of terrible violation, as though everything she kept locked away had been laid out in the open, under a corrosive sunlight. She could still feel the girl in there somehow, looking her over, picking through the debris. The Queen tried to summon anything, any of the thousand small tricks she had wielded over the course of her life. She had not felt so powerless since she was a small girl trapped in a room. The past was supposed to be past. It should not be able to reach up and drag her down.
"What is your name?" the girl asked.
"The Queen of Mortmain."
"No."
The girl walked up and stood right in front of her, only a few inches away, close enough for the Queen to wound. But the Queen couldn't so much as raise a hand. She felt the girl's mind again prying at hers, running fingers over everything, and now she understood that the girl might be able to kill her. No weapon would have done the job, but the girl had found her own knives in the Queen's mind. Each little piece of history that she touched was sharpened to a fine point, and the Queen felt her entire psyche shudder at the violation of that, of having another person handle her identity so easily. The girl had found her answer now, and the pressure in the Queen's mind finally eased.
"Evelyn," the girl murmured.
"You're Evelyn Raleigh. And I am sorry." The Queen of Mortmain closed her eyes. When Isha and the other guards entered the Queen's wing, they found the rest of the guards standing at attention. Even the night shift, who were now well past their bedtimes, had not retired. Bradshaw the magician was leaning against the wall, idly making a scarf vanish and then reappear. Maman was there too. Isha spotted her, standing at attention at the mouth of the hallway, as she always did while waiting for the Queen to come home. The sight of her made Isha want to cry. The mace stomped over to the dais, the grim cast of his face forestalling all questions. Isha followed him as quickly as she dared, keeping her hand on her knife. It was ridiculous, a 12-year-old girl guarding the mace. But the Queen had charged her to do so. And Isha would never forget that moment, not if she lived 100 years. Elston had taken the Queen's charge seriously as well. He followed the mace closely, alert for threats, and when he spotted Isha doing the same, he gave her a jagged, approving grin. Penn was no help. He wandered behind the mace as though lost. He had not wept, as Isha would have expected a lovesick man to do. But he was not with them, either. It was Welmer who finally dared to ask.
"Where's the Queen?"
"Gone."
"Dead?"
The mace searched the room until he found Maman at the entrance to the hallway. She shook her head.
"Not dead," the mace replied. "Just gone."
Arliss was waiting at the foot of the dais. As the mace approached, Arliss handed him a sheet of paper and waited while the mace read. Even when the mace looked up at him with murderous eyes, Arliss did not flinch.
"You knew?"
Arliss nodded.
Why the hell? I don't work for you, Mr. Mace. I serve the Queen. On her orders, nearly 100 copies have already gone out. The thing's done. You're the regent.
Oh, God.
The mace dropped the piece of paper and sat down on the third step of the dais, burying his head in his hands.
What will they do to her?
Welma asked.
They'll take her to Domain.
The voice was unfamiliar. Isha whipped around, drawing her knife. 5 hooded men stood in a group just inside the closed doors of the Queen's wing. The mace pulled his head from his hands, his keen eyes fixing on the leader.
Kib, how did these men get into the wing?
Kib splayed his hands.
I swear, sir, we shut the doors behind you.
The mace nodded, returning his attention to the speaker.
I know your voice, rascal. So you do walk through walls, as the stories tell.
We both do.
The leader shook back his hood, revealing a pleasing, dark-haired face and a tan that spoke of the South.
She's valuable. The Red Queen won't kill her.
Isha wondered how the stranger could be so certain. What value could Queen Kelsey have to the Mort? They could ask for ransom, certainly, but what ransom? Maman said the tier was poor in everything but people and lumber. But the Mort had their own forests, and the Queen would never agree to a trade for people.
It would be a smart move to kill the Queen,
the mace replied.
Leave the tier without an heir and throw us into chaos.
All the same, she will not.
The mace stared at the speaker for a long moment, his eyes measuring. Then he popped to his feet.
Then we need to start today.
The stranger smiled, and it transformed his face from merely pleasant to handsome.
You need people in the capital. I have many. You will have all the help I can give you.
Isha peeked at the rest of the guard and was shocked to see Penn smiling, though his eyes were filled with tears.
We need to get a message to Galen and Dyer in Domain. And Kib,
Mace shouted across the room.
You get down into the wells and find that baker's boy, Nick. Time to call in that favor.
Kib nodded, a small smile creasing his face.
Going to be an undertaking, sir. You're the regent now.
I can do both.
Sir?
Ewan had stepped forward, his friendly face bewildered and his cheeks wet with tears. Isha's heart seemed to contract for him. Everyone knew that Ewan worshipped the Queen, and it seemed likely that he didn't understand what had happened.
What is it, Ewan?
The mace asked, his voice betraying only the slightest touch of impatience.
What are we going to do, sir?
Ewan asked. And Isha saw that she had been wrong. He did understand. The mace descended the dais, clapping Ewan gently on the back.
We're going to do the only thing we can do. We're going to get her back.
I'm sorry, Kelsey repeated. She could feel that terrible side of herself, hovering, gleeful, waiting to be unleashed on the woman who stood before her. A different Kelsey, that one. A Kelsey who saw death as the most complete and effective solution to all problems. She expected the Red Queen to fall to her knees, but she did not. And a moment later, Kelsey realized that this was a woman who would never beg. It was easy to see, to browse through the woman's life in much the same way she browsed through Lily's, to see patterns forming. Evelyn Raleigh, the child, had begged, and it had gained her nothing. The woman would never beg again. Many memories sailed through Kelsey's mind, playing with a set of toy soldiers on the ruined flagstones of a floor, staring with longing at the blue pendulum of a jewel as it rested on a woman's chest, watching from behind a curtain as well-dressed men and women danced in a room that Kelsey recognized easily as her own audience chamber. Evelyn Raleigh had been desperate to be noticed, to matter to others. But in all of those childhood memories, she was alone. It was the adult memories that Kelsey shrank from,
In fragments and pieces, she saw a terrible story, how the disfavored child had risen from obscurity into her own conception of greatness, channeling all of that hurt and disappointment into authoritarianism. Roe Finn had helped her, taught her to do her own form of magic. But Kelsey also sensed an innate emptiness in the grown woman before her, a certainty that an accident of birth had deprived her of greater opportunities. And the loss of the sapphires was a particular sore spot. There was a portrait there, too, in the jumble, and though Kelsey glimpsed it for only a moment, she recognized Lily with no difficulty at all. The Red Queen didn't know Lily from Adam, but she felt a deep connection to her all the same. And now Kelsey saw that Thorn and Roe Finn had only been partly correct. The Red Queen did wish for immortality, but she did not need to live forever. She did not fear death. She only wanted to be invulnerable, to decide her own destiny without being subject to the whims of others. The child, Evelyn, had enjoyed no control over her own life. The Red Queen was determined to control it all. Kelsey took a step back, trying to disengage from this. A greater understanding of others was always valuable, so Carlin said. But understanding the Red Queen would not make the task at hand any easier. For the first time in several weeks, Kelsey thought of Myrne, whom she had effectively anesthetized before his execution. She had no drugs for the Red Queen, but she could at least make it a quick death, not the protracted nightmare she had inflicted on Thorn. But even as Kelsey tried to pull away, she caught and held on a memory. The young Evelyn, perhaps only 11 or 12, standing in front of a mirror. This memory was closely guarded, so closely that when Kelsey began to examine it, the Red Queen's entire body jerked in refusal, and she leapt at Kelsey, her hands hooked into claws. She went right for the sapphires, but Kelsey ducked and shoved her away. The Red Queen flew across the room, bouncing with a hiss off the wall of the tent. Kelsey followed her, still digging, for she sensed the pain that surrounded the memory, exacerbating it, like a wound that had never been cleaned. Evelyn stood in front of a mirror, staring at herself, in the throes of a terrible revelation. "I will never be beautiful." Kelsey recoiled, feeling as though she'd been bitten, slapping the memory away from her as though it were a pernicious insect. But Evelyn's pain did not go easily. Kelsey felt as though it had embedded hooks in her mind. The woman in front of her was beautiful as Kelsey was now. But she had created that beauty, cobbled it together somehow, just as Kelsey had. Deep down, the plain girl still reigned supreme. The Red Queen had never been able to outdistance her, to leave her behind. And in this, Kelsey saw a terrible phantom outline of her own future. The Red Queen was leaning against the wall of the tent now, her breathing labored. But she looked up at Kelsey with furious eyes. "Get out. You have no right." Kelsey withdrew, disengaging from the woman's mind. The Red Queen sagged to the ground, huddling there, her arms wrapped around her knees. Kelsey wanted to apologize, for she saw now the great ugliness of what she had done. But the Red Queen had closed her eyes, dismissing Kelsey somehow. The clear certainty that she would die had permeated the woman's thoughts, calming the tides that lapped there. The Red Queen had lived a long and terrible life, defined by her own casual brutality, and it would be easy, so easy, to dismiss the child who wandered inside her. The dark side of Kelsey wanted to ignore that child. Murder hovered in her mind, ravenous, like a dog straining to be let from the leash. But Kelsey paused, suddenly confronted by a nuance she had never considered. The woman in front of her deserved heavy punishment for the acts she had committed, the terror she had inflicted on the world. But the child, Evelyn, was not responsible for what had been done to her, and the experiences of the child
had forever shaped the woman.
Kelsey's mind clamored, hectoring, demanding that she do something, that she act.
But still she hesitated, staring at the crouching woman before her. The problems of the past.
Her own voice echoed in her mind, and Kelsey wished Mace were there, for she felt that she could finally explain this particular conundrum, present him with a concrete example of how the problems of the past, uncorrected, inevitably became the problems of the future.
"I can't kill her," Kelsey realized.
An army surrounded them, an army that would enter New London and lay it waste. This was Kelsey's only option, her only chance. But she could not bring herself to do the act. Compassion had ruined everything.
"Open your eyes," Kelsey commanded, and as she spoke the words, she felt the dark shadow inside her crumple and limp away, its wings tattered.
It might circle her mind forever, seeking advantage, but at that moment, Kelsey knew that it would never control her again. The Red Queen opened her eyes, and the rage Kelsey saw there made her flinch. She had intruded where she had no right to be, and this woman would always hate her for what she had discovered there. Again, Kelsey considered apologizing, but the memory of William Tyr intruded. The main prize.
"I propose a trade. I will give you my sapphires."
"In exchange for what?"
After a moment of initial surprise, the Red Queen's face smoothed over, and Kelsey felt unwilling admiration.
So she, too, had the power to wipe away the past when it served no purpose, when it would only be a distraction. Kelsey would earn no points for sparing the Red Queen's life, that expression said.
This woman would drive a hard bargain. "Autonomy for the Tyr?"
The Queen chuckled, but sobered quickly when she saw Kelsey's expression. "You are serious."
"Yes."
"I will give you the necklaces. Take them off willingly. And you will withdraw your army and not return for 5 years. During this time you will not place one toe in my kingdom. You will demand nothing. You will leave my people alone." 5 years worth of lost profits from the shipment. You must be out of your mind." But beneath the smooth face of the hard bargainer, Kelsey read a different story. Here, at least, Thorn and Finn had been right. The Red Queen wanted the jewels very badly.
"I promise you, if you refuse to trade with me, you will never have my sapphires.
I may rot and wither to nothing, and you will still never be able to take them off me without facing the consequences."
"They belong to me."
5 years is too long." "Majesty," Dukat blurted out. Kelsey had forgotten he was there, crouched in the far corner of the tent. "You cannot."
"Shut up, Benin."
"Majesty, I will not."
Dukat stood up, and Kelsey saw that he too was furious, but not with her.
"The army has been incredibly patient with the lack of plunder, but it cannot last forever. New London is their reward. Poorly defended, full of women and children. They have earned that."
"You'll get your 10%, Benin. I'll pay you out of my own pocket."
Dukat shook his head. "You will, Majesty, but that will not solve the issue. The army is already angry, to be withdrawn at the moment of victory."
Kelsey was on the point of silencing him.
She did not need his interference, not when she sensed her opponent weakening.
But there was no need.
The Red Queen turned to face him, and Dukat blanched, falling silent. "You think my army would defy me, Benin?" "No, Majesty, no."
Dukat backpedaled.
"But they are already discontented. Poor morale makes poor soldiers. This is established." "They will tamp down their discontent if they know what's good for them."
The Red Queen turned back to Kelsey, her eyes gleaming, dark pupils flickering between Kelsey's face and the sapphires.
2 years." "You must not want them very badly." 5 years is too long. the Red Queen repeated, a hint of sullenness in her voice.
3 years. Done.
Kelsey held the jewels out, but kept the chains around her neck.
Take hold of them.
The Red Queen eyed her warily.
Why?
It's a trick I learned from our mutual friend.
Kelsey smiled at her.
I need to make sure you won't back out of the deal.
The Red Queen's eyes widened, suddenly fearful, and Kelsey saw that she had meant to do exactly that.
Ah, she was smart, this woman, clever enough to drive a hard bargain on a promise she meant to break.
I know you now, Evelyn. 3 years, that's the honest bargain.
Kelsey lifted the sapphires, offering them.
Promise to leave my kingdom alone?
The Red Queen took the sapphires on her palm, and Kelsey was relieved to see a myriad of conflicting emotions cross her face. Lust, anger, anxiety, regret.
She knew about Roe Finn then. Perhaps she'd even seen his real face.
Majesty, Ducat hissed, do not!
The Red Queen's face twisted, and a moment later Ducat was curled in a fetal position, moaning on the floor. The woman's eyes were fixed on the sapphires now, and when Kelsey hunted for her pulse, she found it ratcheted sky high. Lust had overtaken judgment. The Red Queen paused, clearly framing her words before she spoke.
If you give me both tear sapphires, freely, of your own will, I swear to remove my army from the Tearling, and to refrain from interfering with the Tearling for the next 3 years.
Kelsey smiled, feeling tears spill down her cheeks.
You leaped like a faucet, the Red Queen snapped. Give me the jewels.
3 years, Kelsey thought.
They were safe now, all of them, from the farmers in the Almont to Andalai's children in the keep. Safe in Mace's good hands. And that knowledge allowed Kelsey to reach up and pull the chains over her head. She expected the necklaces to fight her hand or inflict some terrible physical punishment when she tried to remove them. But they came off easily. And when the Red Queen snatched them away, Kelsey felt almost nothing. Only a small pang for Lily, for the end of Lily's story that she would never see. But even that loss was drowned under the great gain of this moment. 3 years was a lifetime. The Red Queen put on both necklaces and then turned away, huddling over the sapphires like a miser with his gold. It occurred to Kelsey in that moment that she might escape. Ducat was still incapacitated, and she could duck out of the tent, perhaps take them all by surprise. But no. The jewels were lost to her now, and without them, she was just an ordinary prisoner. She would make it no more than 5 feet before getting killed. Or worse. And anyway, the bridge was broken.
Kelsey had done it as a defensive measure. But now she wondered if she hadn't really been trying to ensure that there was no going back.
The Red Queen turned, and Kelsey braced herself for the triumph on the woman's face, the vengeance that would surely follow. The Tearling was safe, and she meant to die a queen.
But the Red Queen's eyes were wide with outrage, her nostrils flaring. Her outstretched fist had closed around the jewels, squeezing so tightly that her knuckles had turned white.
Her mouth worked, opening and closing. Her other hand had clenched into a claw, and it reached for Kelsey, clutching madly.
And then somehow, Kelsey knew. She began to laugh,
wild, hysterical laughter that bounced off the gleaming red walls of the tent. She barely felt the bruising grip of the woman's hand on her shoulder.
Of course it didn't hurt when I took them off. Of course not, because
they're mine. The Red Queen screamed with fury, a wordless howl that seemed as though it would shred the walls of the tent. Her hand ground into Kelsey's shoulder so hard that Kelsey thought it might break, but she couldn't stop laughing.
They don't work for you, do they?
She leaned toward the Red Queen until their faces were only inches apart.
You can't use them. They're mine.
The Queen hauled back and slapped Kelsey again, knocking her to the ground. But even this couldn't stop Kelsey's laughter. Indeed, it seemed to feed it. She thought of the long night past. Lily, William Tyr, Penn, Jonathan, Mace. And it suddenly seemed that they were there with her, all of them, even the dead. Kelsey had hoped to emerge victorious, but here was an outcome that she had never imagined. The jewels were lost to her. She would never find out how Lily's story had ended. But neither would anyone else. Rough hands were on her shoulders, pulling her from the ground. Men dressed in black like the soldiers outside. But by now, Kelsey recognized close guards when she saw them. And she shut her eyes, preparing for death.
"Get her out of here!"
the Red Queen shrieked.
"Get her out!"
One of them, clearly the captain, pinned Kelsey's wrists behind her back, and she felt irons cuffing them into place. The irons were too tight. They pinched her skin as he snapped the clasps. But Kelsey still couldn't stop laughing.
"You lost," she told the Red Queen, and knew that she would never forget the woman's face in that moment. The face of an enraged child denied dessert.
Kelsey barely felt the guard's hands tighten on her arms, yanking her out of the tent.
The Tearling was safe. Her people were safe.
The sapphires belonged to her, no one else. And Kelsey roared with laughter, even as they hauled her away. And at the end, the crossing. Lily clutched a line of rope on the railing, trying not to fall to the deck. The ship rocked wildly. The water was roiling, stirred by wind and the thunder of explosions on land. Above them, storm clouds were highlighted against the night sky, a swirling purple bruise. Lily had been on ships before, but those had been powerboats, yachts that had cut so smoothly through the waves that they barely felt as though they were moving at all. This was different, a terrible funhouse feeling, the ship's deck literally rocking beneath her feet as she clutched the rope, trying desperately to support Jonathan with her other arm. Jonathan was barely conscious. Tyr had removed the bullet and stitched him up in the car, but by the time he was done, the back seat was covered in blood, and Tyr's grim expression had said it all. Far behind them was the skyline of New York, a smouldering orange wreck of dark buildings whose windows gouted flame into the black night. But Lily and the other people on the ship were not looking at the skyline. Their gazes were fixed on the sea behind them, on the two huge ships that had materialized from nowhere. From the shouted reports on deck, Lily also knew that there were several submarines out there rapidly closing beneath the surface. They had been all right as they sailed down the Hudson and entered the lower bay. But then a siren had gone off, and now, as they moved out into the Atlantic, security was closing. 5 minutes, William Tyr shouted from the prow of the ship. All we need.
He is insane, Lily realized. Oddly, it didn't seem to matter much.
They weren't going to make it, and Lily was sorry for that. Sorry that she would never get to see the deep, clean river beneath the bright sun. But these ships were free, and Lily was going to die a free woman, and she would not have been anywhere else at this moment for the wide world, submarines or not.
Ready, Tyr shouted,
and the computer tech near Lily began to chatter into his earpiece in their strange language. A hollow boom echoed on Lily's left, followed by distant screams. When she craned her neck to see over the beams that covered the deck, she found that one of Tyr's ships was on fire, its back end flaming, gouts of black smoke billowing up into the night.
"Torpedo!"
someone cried. A second explosion echoed, and then the ship wasn't even half a ship anymore. only a smouldering ruin on the heaving ocean. Everyone on the deck of Lily's ship had run to the railing, but Lily could not leave Jonathan, so only she saw William Tyr turn away, clutching something in his outstretched right hand, all of his attention focused on the eastern horizon. "We're not even armed," a woman cried. The destroyers were closing now, less than half a mile away. Lily wondered why they hadn't fired as well, but after a moment's consideration, she knew. They meant to take the rest of Tyr's ships, to board them. Security loved its prisoners, after all. Lily's burn wound throbbed, even though her palm had scabbed over with a dark crust, and she knew that whatever happened, she wasn't going back. Bright light suddenly engulfed the ship, blinding. Lily threw her hands over her eyes, a low squeal escaping her throat, thinking of the halo device that Tyr's people had used in the security compound. Terror suddenly overwhelmed her. The terror that it had all been a dream, that she would wake up and find herself back in that room, facing the accountant, the box. But when she peeked through her fingers, she saw that this light wasn't electric. It was plain old daylight, a soft glow on her arms. Lily turned toward the light and screamed. There was a hole in the eastern horizon. Lily had no other way to describe what she saw. The black shawl of night still covered the sky above her head, but as it dipped east, the shawl tore open, its jagged edges surrounding the hole like a broken portrait frame. Inside the frame was day, a pink and orange horizon above the azure water, as though the sun were about to rise. The light bathed everything, and Lily could see all of the other ships around her now, clearly, their flying sails stained orange in the dawn. Thunder boomed behind them, shaking the deck. "Get down!" a man cried, and Lily ducked, covering her head. But the whistling shot went right over them, over all of the ships, toward the hole in the horizon. Hatred blazed inside Lily so strong that if any security officer had appeared in front of her in that instant, she would have torn his heart out with her bare hands. They were trying to close whatever doorway Tyr had opened, trying to take the better world. "Tell them to get through," Tyr shouted from the prow. "We don't have long." Their ship was in the lead, nearing the hole, and now Lily could feel warmth on her arms, the heat of sunlight against her skin. A cacophony of screams rang across the deck, wild screams from the people at the railing, and now Lily was screaming herself, feeling as though her entire body were tethered to that open horizon. As they passed through, she let go of the rope and hoisted Jonathan up, shaking him awake. "The better world," she shouted in his ear. "The better world." But Jonathan did not open his eyes. All around her, on the deck and on the other ships, Lily could hear them, her people, their cries of jubilation echoing across the open ocean. Behind them, the hole still remained, a dark stain through which nothing was visible against the western horizon. At least 15 ships had made it through, but now the edges of the hole were collapsing inward, its circumference beginning to shrink. Lily didn't know if the last ships would make it. Turning back to the east, she found William Tyr clutching the railing, his face white as a sheet. For a moment, his entire body seemed to glow pure blue against the rising sun, and then he collapsed to the deck. Lily turned to tell Jonathan, but Jonathan was dead.
"Lily?"
She looked up, squinting in the dim moonlight, and scrambled to her feet. Tyr looked exhausted. Lily hadn't seen him in 2 days, not since that night, and she was relieved to see him up and about. The longer he was absent from the deck, the more certain Lily became that he had somehow killed himself performing his miracle, that he, like Jonathan, would not wake up. Lily had asked Dorian about Tyr, but Dorian was non-committal.
Lily had tried to make friends with several of the other passengers and found them kind but cautious. No one knew who she was. A younger woman, perhaps Dorian's age, had patched her wounds. But for the past 2 days there had been nothing for Lily to do but sit by herself, watch the horizon, and wait for Tyr.
"Are you all right?"
"I'm fine," he replied.
But Lily still had her doubts. He looked like a man who had suffered some sort of wasting illness.
"But I need your help. Come with me."
She followed him toward the stern, trying to tiptoe quietly among the sleeping people who covered the deck. Tyr, as always, seemed to make no noise at all, and he led her down the ladder to the deep hold below decks. The hold had a strange medieval feel, for only lamps and firelight lit all of its rooms.
No electric lights anywhere.
A broad dormitory-like area lined with empty cots took up the bulk of the hold. There were over 100 people on this ship, but most of them didn't want to spend time inside. They preferred to stay on deck, their eyes scouring the horizon. Tyr had prepared for this eventuality. At the far end of the dormitory was a room that contained not only plenty of food and water, but about 50 gallons of sunscreen. Lily thought this room was where they were going, but Tyr bypassed it for the next, which was understood to be private for his use only. As they walked in, Lily saw that the room's walls were lined with bookshelves, each of them filled with hundreds of books. But Lily had no time to marvel at these. In the center of the room, Dorian was standing over a table, staring down at what could only be a body wrapped in a sheet, the shroud sewn together by hasty fingers.
"It's time, Dory."
She looked up, and Lily saw, even in the dim glow of firelight, that her eyes were reddened from long crying. She looked a question at Lily.
"He would want her here,"
Tyr replied. He levered an arm beneath the corpse's shoulders, hauling it up.
"Come on, all together."
Dorian grasped Jonathan's waist, leaving Lily to take the legs. Together, they heaved the body off the table, balancing it carefully on their shoulders. Lily could smell the corpse now, a hint of decay that seeped right through the sheet. But she ignored it, thinking of Jonathan, who had thought she was worth saving, who would never see the better world. Her eyes watered, and she wiped at them savagely, stinging her corneas as they started up the stairs. On deck, everything was quiet except for the waves lapping gently at the sides of the ship. In the moonlight, Lily could just glimpse the other ships on either side of them, not too far off, keeping pace. In the end, only 17 of them had made it through. 3 were lost, sunk forever in Hudson Bay. From overheard conversations, Lily knew that not all of the ships were packed with people like this one. One ship carried livestock, cows, sheep, and goats. Another carried horses. Still another, its boards bleached nearly white, was carrying medical supplies and personnel. But all Lily could see now were the sails, little more than faint gleams under the dying moon. They carried Jonathan to the rear of the ship, a place where few people chose to sleep, because the rigging blocked the view of the eastern horizon. At Tyr's direction, they balanced the body carefully on the railing. Lily's arms ached, but she gave no sign of it. The burn on her palm had broken open again, oozing pus, but she hid that as well, surreptitiously blotting it on her jeans. She wished she had some clean clothes. She hadn't showered in days. Other people were still wearing the same outfits as the night they'd launched. What would they do for clothing in the new world? There were so many uncertainties, and the only man who could answer them was Tyr. But now wasn't the time. Beyond the helm, the eastern sky was turning pale, but when Lily peeked over the railing at the stern, she could see nothing but darkness.
"Jonathan hated the water,"
Dorian remarked hoarsely, and Lily realized that she was crying again.
After what they did to him, he fucking hated it.
Not this water, Tyr replied.
Lily said nothing. They had known Jonathan well, both of them, and she had never even learned his last name. She wanted to think of something to say, something important, but when she closed her eyes, all she could see was Greg on his knees, Jonathan holding a pistol to his head. That was the greatest kindness anyone had ever done for Lily, but it wasn't an act she could tell Tyr and Dorian about. So she remained silent, though tears had begun to work their way slowly down her cheeks.
"Well, old friend," Tyr finally said, "we're off to a good land. Let's hope you're already there."
"Amen, South Carolina," Dorian added. And then, by unspoken consent, they lifted the body over the railing. Lily didn't help this time, only stood back. There was a muted splash, and then Jonathan was gone forever. Dorian waited another moment, then left without a word, walking quickly toward the stairs.
"I killed him," Lily thought.
"It was his choice," Tyr repeated, making Lily wonder if she'd actually spoken out loud.
She looked around, but they were still alone at the stern.
"What happened? Where did we go?"
"Nowhere, Lily. We crossed, that's all. That's how I've always thought of it."
"Is it?"
Lily forced herself to bring out the word.
"Is it magic?"
"Magic," Tyr repeated. "I never thought of it that way. To me, it seems the most natural thing in the world, but maybe magic is a good word."
He reached into his pocket and came up with something clenched in his fist.
"Have a look."
Lily held out her uninjured hand and felt him drop something cold and hard into her palm. She held it up, squinting, trying to make it out. The sky had lightened now in the sudden way it did just before dawn, but it still took Lily a few moments to identify the object.
"Aquamarine?"
"Sapphire," Tyr replied. "My family tree is documented all the way back to Cromwell, but that jewel has been with us since the Dark Ages. Maybe even further back than that."
Lily held the sapphire to the light, trying to see through it, but the sun hadn't appeared yet, and it was only a dark rectangle against the pale sky.
"How do you know?"
"It told me."
Lily snorted, but Tyr hadn't cracked so much as a smile. She couldn't tell whether he was joking, so she handed the sapphire back and leaned over the railing, staring down at the dim lines of white left in the ship's wake.
"Are you healing, Lily?"
That was a difficult question to answer.
During the day, things were fine because the sky was wide open and Lily could look from horizon to horizon. But she didn't sleep more than a few hours at a time before jerking awake, certain that she would see the accountant standing in front of her. Or worse, Greg. They were out of reach of all of that now, the ship's prow cutting smoothly toward the better world. But Lily felt a sudden, terrible foreboding. All of the people around her, sleeping on the deck, surely they brought their own stories, their own violence? How could anyone build a better world, a perfect world, if people brought along their own nightmares of the past?
"It won't be perfect," Tyr answered, staring moodily over the railing. "I knew that, almost as soon as I knew I would try to do it. The world will be better, but not easy. In fact, in the early going, it's going to be very difficult."
"What do you mean?"
"Look at what we've left behind, Lily. We have no electricity. No technology. While I was asleep, Dory had the computer techs dump all of their equipment overboard, along with the guns. It has to be that way. Technology is convenient, but we've long since passed the point where convenience outweighed danger. Tools of surveillance, of control. I knew long ago that these would have to be the first things to go. But think of the other things we won't have. Fuel, heat,
textiles.
I've brought drugs and antibiotics on the white ship over there.
He gestured northward.
But they'll go bad long before the decade is out. We'll have none of these things, unless we figure out how to make them ourselves with whatever we find.
Lily struggled to remain silent. She worshipped this man, she realized now, and it was a difficult thing to hear him tear himself to pieces. But she suspected that he could not voice these doubts to anyone else, certainly not to all of the loyal people who had followed him for years.
There will be animals in the New World for meat, but we're all going to have to learn to kill them without guns or machinery, to cook from scratch over an open fire. We'll have to grow food. We'll have to learn to build our own houses, make our own clothing. I have several people who know the process, from sheep to wool to weaving, but the rest we'll have to learn. There was no way to do this without throwing nearly everything away, and if we want to keep anything, we're going to have to learn to do it all over again.
You think we can't?
We can, certainly. The question is whether we will. It takes effort to build, Lily. It takes effort to put the community's needs before your own. But in the coming period, everyone will have to do that, or we're doomed to fail.
Socialism has never succeeded anywhere.
So we keep on trying. These are civic-minded people. They will raise civic-minded children. I chose them as such.
Me as well?
Tia smiled. You as well.
How do you know I'm civic-minded?
Truthfully, even Lily didn't know if she was. There had been so little opportunity to find out.
Her entire life with Greg played out inside her memory, an ugly feedback loop.
I told you, Lily, I've known you all my life.
Tyr held up the sapphire, displaying it on his palm.
I saw you here, long before I ever knew who you were.
Why? Tyr stared at her for a moment, his gaze contemplative.
Are you healing?
Yes. My shoulder barely even hurts, except when I try to sleep. My hands being a pain, but I can bandage it again once there's enough light.
You don't fool me, Lily. Your injuries aren't physical. You're not healing yet, but you will.
Lily felt her cheeks flush, wondering if he could look straight inside her and see the nightmares, Greg constantly lurking. It seemed likely that Greg would always be there, dug into some part of Lily that refused to let the past go.
It might be that way for a long time,
Tyr told her,
but I promise you, you will heal.
How do you know?
Tyr closed his fingers around the sapphire for a moment, staring off into some place that Lily couldn't possibly begin to imagine.
Then he held it out to her.
Have a look.
Feeling foolish, Lily lifted the jewel to the sky again, squinting. For a moment, she saw nothing. But then the sapphire began to glow from within, a tiny blue flame against the lightning sky. What?
Shh! Look!
Lily stared at the sapphire, trying not to blink. And after a moment, she realized that a figure was forming, far beneath the surface. At first, it was shadowy, only a silhouette against the blue background. But then Lily gasped, for she saw herself.
This was a different Lily than the one she had seen in the mirror all of her life.
Careworn and slightly hardened, her arms muscled, her skin dark with sun. The woman turned, and now Lily saw what Tyr had meant her to see. Her stomach, rounded with late pregnancy, protruding against the blue. How are you doing this? She asked. Is it an illusion?
No illusion, Lily. Only the future. I promise you, it will come to pass.
Lily stared at herself, fascinated. The woman in the jewel had not had an easy life, clearly, and yet she radiated contentment. Flowers had been braided into her hair, and on her back was what appeared to be a bow and a quiver filled with arrows.
But for the rounded belly, she looked like the picture of Diana in the old douleur Lily and Maddie had shared in their childhood.